No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to us at BBSRADIO and the number 1. Tonight we have a special guest, we hope. We're having a little problem getting a hold of him, but I'm sure he'll be here in a minute or two. And his name is Dan, is it Pella? Pella, how do you pronounce his name, Maria?
Pella is my understanding.
Pella. And well, tell us about him. You know him.
Well, Dan has written, I believe at last count, it was 15 books about the IRS and what you can and cannot do. And it sounds, I can't tell if he's got an axe to grind or if he's just wanting us to stay as informed as possible. And since it is the season, we thought it would be timely to have his advice and, you know, helping us with what it is that we may or may not do. I guess there are some things that that are legal that we don't know about, or maybe because I'm not one, I've never been one to cheat. I don't, it's not worth it to me. I like to sleep at night. So, but he has a tax help online as a website, and he's been doing this. He considers himself a premier expert in tax problem resolution and IR abuse prevention, and he's been doing it for over 30 years. So he's been at it for quite some time. And he founded the Tax Freedom Institute also.
Well, I cannot imagine that you can be an American taxpayer and not have an axe to grind with the IRS. That's just my, you know, in terms of full disclosure, I just want to be out there. I ran a small business for 25 years, and I had so many battles with the IRS.
Did you?
Oh, my God, yeah. Because I learned very early on that you have to dispute everything. Now, I'll tell you that I had an incident last year where my identity had been stolen. Somebody put in for my wife's tax, my tax return and my wife's tax return. So now we have to use a PIN number to file our taxes. And of course, as fate would have it, right, it's the one year that we're due a big refund, right? Because we've got kids in college and a bunch of other deductions. And it took, instead of, you know, like the normal 2 to 3 weeks that it's been taking lately to get your tax return, it took us 10 months to get our refund. But
you're kidding.
No,
Michael, that's terrible.
We had to fight. But you know what? I will say the IRS was very, very nice about it. Nicer than I remember as when I was in business. And the problem last year seemed to be that they didn't have enough personnel. That personnel has been cut so much at the IRS. They, you know, they were very sympathetic and they tried to help, but it seemed like, you know, because of budget cuts, they weren't, you know, they had more cases than they could handle, because as they've cut the budget for those positions, of course, the need for those positions has grown. The one woman told me that people stealing tax returns have a tripled last year from the year before. Tripled. So identity theft of your tax refund has become evidently a big deal.
I always wonder, these people who are doing these things, these highly sophisticated, fairly exacting ways of bilking us, if they could only take that great mind of theirs and put it to solving cancer or, you know, world peace or something that would be noble, water, clean drinking water for everybody on this planet, instead of trying to steal.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I mean, it's just amazing to me. I think part of the problem, too, with that is that they now we have this this automatic deposit. You know, when you get your refund, it goes right into your account. Mm-hmm. Well, in the good old days when they had to send you a check, it was a little more complicated, right? Now all you have to do is give them a bank account number, and they put the money directly into your account. And I think these guys open these accounts. And what happens is they try to get as many refunds as they can in a very short period of time. And then they close the account, you know, and they're out of there.
Send it to me. I don't have a pen right around me.
So that seems to be the problem, too, is that things have changed. But anyway, the IRS. I was just going to say that part of the problem, too, with identity theft and the IRS is that now they deposit the money directly so people can have it sent anywhere in the world electronically, as opposed to, you know, actually having to physically pick up a check or provide an address that a check would go to. While we're waiting for Dan, let me tell you my favorite IRS story.
Okay, please.
I once got this, when I was in business, I once got a notice from the IRS saying you owe back taxes from the previous year. We've calculated that you owe us, I don't know, something like $1,000. And you owe us a $350 penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself,
and
that
interest.
Yes, and interest. But that year I paid a lot of taxes. I paid $30,000 or $40,000 in taxes. And I thought to myself, well, a 35% penalty on $1,000 is an awful lot of money to pay. So I could, you know, I just as a matter of course, you know, I thought it was unjust. So I called up and I argued with the IRS about it. There's a law that says that if you pay, I think it's, I can't remember if it's 90% or 110% of your taxes from the previous year, no matter how much money you make, they can't penalize you, okay? So I made the argument that I paid that much. And at one point, the IRS guy said, well, you didn't pay 100%, you paid 99.5%. And I said, what? And he said, 99%. And I said, you know, I don't know where you come from, pal, but where I come from, we round up. Okay, so so in my book, that's 100%. A 99.5 is an A, no matter how you grade it. And he finally said to me, and I swear I'm not lying, well, if you want to, we can put this to the automated decision maker.
You're
kidding.
And I
said,
I keep saying that to you. I'm so sorry. Everything you say today is causing me a bunch of surprises.
Yes, he said, we have a computer and we'll feed all the information into it. And if it decides that you're right, then fine, we'll abate the penalty. But you have to agree to abide by whatever the computer says. You must agree in advance. And I said, okay. Like, what the hell do I have to lose, right? If it decides against me, they're already going to make me pay the penalty. So the worst that can happen is that I'll have to pay the penalty. Well, the guy comes back 3 minutes later, and the computer agreed with me. And I laughed so hard because I argued with the guy for 20 minutes, and I couldn't get him to see my point of view. But the computer agreed with me. And then they read me this statement that went on for about 10 minutes about how, since this was the first time and it never happened before, but this doesn't give you an exemption for the future and blah, 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 blah. We're going to abate the penalty. And they abated the penalty. So
yay.
See if you can argue with the computer next time. That's my advice.
So we do have Dan on the line with us. Dan, welcome to Shadow Politics.
I'm glad I'm here.
Yes, us too. We're just curious what you've learned in the 30 years plus that you've been at this, what we should know, especially since we're in the season.
Well, what I've learned is that taxpayers have so many rights when they're dealing with the IRS. If you know just a little bit about your rights, you'll never be run over by the agency. I've learned that. I've also learned that the IRS doesn't tell the truth about taxpayers' rights. They use misinformation and disinformation. They in some cases, they just outright bold-faced lie to people concerning what their rights are and what the IRS's limitations are. And so that's why it falls to the citizen to have to know what his rights are and how to deal with the IRS, because they're not going to tell you. I also know that the IRS is wrong about half the time in the actions that it takes with citizens, whether it's a computer notice, a penalty assessment, an audit result. And as a matter of fact, their own statistics indicate that the audit results are wrong between 60 to 90% of the time. And my own experience in dealing with the IRS in audits and appeals and tax court cases indicates that that's at least true. And so, yeah, I've learned a great deal. I've learned a great deal in dealing with the IRS over the last 35 years.
Well, I got to tell you, Dan, this is Senator Brown. I used to run my own business. And as a small businessman, there's no love lost between me and the IRS. But I made a policy of fighting everything, every notice I got, I contested because of the last comment that you just made. And I found out, I bet I contested 10 notices over the 25 years. And only once did I find out of those 10 times, only once was the IRS right.
That doesn't surprise me at all, Senator. And I'll tell you something else. The IRS's own statistics indicate that their notices are wrong about 48% of the time. Okay, that's 50-50. Flip a coin and you're going to be right half the time when you're dealing with these notices. So you always have to respond to the notices. You always have to challenge them. Even if you don't understand the notice, even if you don't know what the IRS is talking about, you got to challenge them because you got a 50-50 chance that they are just simply flat wrong.
Well, who can stay in business with those kinds of odds?
Well, it's very difficult. The fact of the matter is the General Accounting Office once did an analysis of the burdens that are placed on small businesses by the Internal Revenue Code. Now, understand that this analysis was done in the early part of this century, so it did not involve Obamacare. It did not involve the FATCA Act. It did not involve any of the Obama tax changes that occurred between 2010, 2011 forward, all right? Didn't cover any of those things. The General Accounting Office, Government Accountability Office, determined that there's 200 separate burdens that are put on businesses, broken down into four different categories. We don't have to get technical about this. But the bottom line is there's an inordinate amount of burdens and affirmative responsibilities that are put on businesses, most particularly in the area of dealing with employees. Now, you know, the leftists in government can't figure out why small companies don't want to hire workers. And the reason is because the burdens are so tremendous under the tax laws. When you have employees, nobody wants to undertake the burden.
Well, I got to say, you know, I as a small businessman, yes, between the local tax authority and the IRS, I had to file at least 36 documents a year, and I had one employee. There were only two of us, so that is a terrible burden. And something else that really bothered me, and I think this has changed at the IRS. You tell me if this was wrong, if I'm wrong about this. But it used to seem to me that when I was in business, if they were in doubt, they charged you. You know, it was like, they said, well, we're not exactly sure about this, but let's fine him and penalize him anyway. And if we're wrong, he'll prove it to us. You know, like they pushed off the burden on you.
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head. The Internal Revenue Service is different from every other law enforcement agency in America. And they're more like law enforcement agencies in a totalitarian regime. And the law enforcement agencies in totalitarian regimes shoot first and they never bother to ask questions. That's what the IRS does. The burden of proof is on the citizen. In a civil situation, in a dollars and cents dispute with the IRS never has to prove you did it wrong. you always have to prove you did it right. The burden of proof is on you. So they can make whatever claim they want to make, however they want to make it. There's no evidence whatsoever to support their claim. They know there's no evidence. They don't care that there's no evidence because you've got the burden to prove them wrong.
Right, and that's the way they were set up, I think, because when the IRS was founded, one of the and income tax was established, I think one of the fears they had is that people just wouldn't pay it. So they set them up that way, and it is really, really terrible. You know, and they intimidate people. If you have a tax lien, everybody knows this. If you have a tax lien on your house and you go to settlement, I don't care if it's $5, you can't sell the house. The IRS is very, very powerful, and they don't have to go through the court system ever. They just do. I mean, if there is a totalitarian branch of the American government, I agree with you, it's the IRS.
So, Dan, ask you how you got this passion? Was there a case that really disturbed you, or was there something that you discovered that led you on to, because this is a passion of yours for over 30 years.
It is. I've been doing this for coming up on 36 years now. I've written 14 books on dealing with the IRS. I've written dozens and dozens of research reports on tax law and tax policy. I've written thousands of articles over the years on every aspect of the IRS and tax law and tax enforcement and tax policy that you can imagine, including all, you know, the Obamacare stuff. So yeah, it is a passion of mine. And the way I got started let me just turn back the hands of time here to about the early 1970s. My father had a small business in our hometown of St. Paul, Minnesota, got behind on his employees withholding taxes, and the IRS in 1974 padlocked the doors on his shop and auctioned the equipment off for a couple cents on the dollar. I was a sophomore in high school when that happened. They auctioned the equipment off for a couple cents on the dollar. My dad was out of business. So about five, 6 years later, they turned their attention to the family home, and they tried to seize and sell it for the back tax liability. And I remember coming home one day. I was about 19 years old, and I walked in the door, and my mom hands me this letter from the IRS, and she says, you know, what do you make of this? And I read this, and I said, well, it looks like they're going to try to take the house. And she says, what do we do about it? Well, of course, I had no idea what to do. But what I did is I went over to the local law library. We lived in just right on the edge of downtown St. Paul. There was a law school on the other side of town. I went into their law library. I started fumbling around in the Internal Revenue Code. I mean, literally fumbling around, and stumbled on an area of the tax code that deals with taxpayers' rights issues and limits the power of the IRS. I started reading in this section of the code. I didn't get 6 pages into this area and discovered that the IRS was proceeding illegally to seize my mom's house. So I did what any teenager would do under the circumstances. I sued the IRS. I pasted together, I pasted together a Mickey Mouse lawsuit based on the books that I saw in the library. I sued the IRS. Pretty soon I found myself in a federal court in Minneapolis in front of a federal judge. The IRS flew an attorney in from the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., who wanted my case thrown out. And I stood there in front of the judge and I said, Judge, you know, they're trying to take the house. The law says they can't. You know, here's what the law says. And I read the code section to them, and they shouldn't be allowed to do this. And it was about as polished as my argument was. There was nothing to it. 2 minutes, and I sat down. And this attorney from the Justice Department stood up, and he started blathering all kinds of things about code section this and case law that. I had no idea what this guy was talking about. But when he was done, the judge looked at him and pointed at me and said, he's right, and he slammed the gavel. And I thought, this is easy, baby. We shut down the IRS and kept them from taking the house, and I've been stopping them ever since.
Well, you're my new hero, Dan.
I was going to say, what a great story that is. And I love the genesis that it came about so organically.
Well, I don't want to digress here, but when I was 15, both my parents died. We had no money. We had no, we didn't even own a house. The only thing we owned was an old car. My dad didn't pay taxes for years. He was estranged from my mother. It's a coincidence that they died very closely together, but he was estranged from my mother. He hadn't lived with us in 7 years, but my mother and me and my sister and brother paid off the car. And when it was paid off, the IRS came in and repossessed it, auctioned it off for a third of what it was worth because my dad had a $60,000 tax liability. And this was back in the 1960s. And
what a punch in the stomach.
They got $500 for the car.
What a punch in the stomach. My dad had 10,000 square feet of a printing operation with every machine you could imagine having to do with printing in the 1970s. The IRS auctioned that, all of that equipment off, a lifetime worth of equipment, for under $1,000. And they took half of the money they applied to the cost of sale. It didn't even go to the tax liability.
So now, they basically ran you out of business.
Well, yeah, certainly, no question. But let's fast forward here now. All right, what happened to your parents, Senator, and what happened to my father never has to happen to another taxpayer again. And I'll tell you why. In 1999, we're talking 15 years ago now, Congress passed the IRS Restructuring Reform Act. I was a consultant to the National Commission on Restructuring the IRS, and I worked with the commission on building certain provisions into the Internal Revenue Code that would protect taxpayers and level the playing field so the IRS didn't have this kind of unfettered power. One of the provisions we added to the tax code as a result of the Restructuring Act was what we call a collection due process appeal rights. Now, before the IRS can touch a nickel's worth of your assets, they have to send a special notice called a final notice of intent to levy. That notice gives you an appeal right. When you act within the time frame allowed by law, it's 30 days allowed by law, you do two important things. Number one, you stop enforcement in its tracks. The seizure you talked about, Senator, and the seizure I talked about will never happen again. And now the case goes into the hands of the appeals office. And appeals then has sole jurisdiction to consider what are called collection alternatives. Now the taxpayer can step up and say, look, you guys want all the money, but I can't afford to pay the money. Maybe I can do an installment agreement. Maybe I can't afford to pay anything. I can get what's called uncollectible status. Maybe I can do an offer and compromise. Maybe I don't owe the penalties. Maybe I don't even owe the tax. There's all kinds of strategies that we can use to keep the IRS from running you over. Those tools are available now if you know how to use them.
Wow.
Well, you know,
that's saying a lot.
Yes, and I've noticed this in dealing with them. Now, they become more, at least on the surface, and you tell me how deeply this goes, they become more customer friendly. Because the notices that you used to get from the IRS, I mean, they were almost funny in the way they read. You know, that you owed a little amount of money and it would say something like, you are in default. You must pay this immediately, or we can put a lien on your house, garnish your salary, you know, take your children. I mean, they were really, really draconian. And it seems like they don't do that anymore. But I don't know. Is that just a PR thing, or have they become kinder and gentler?
Well, it's an interesting turn of phrase that you use, kinder and gentler, because I use that phrase in my book, How to Get Tax Amnesty, which talks about how to negotiate with the IRS and get settlements for tax debt that you can't pay. I use that phrase, kinder and gentler, to describe an IRS policy. They call it the Fresh Start policy, that allows people that are in way over their heads and are never going to be able to pay the taxes they owe to negotiate settlements. But Senator, here's the thing, that there's really two different families, if you will, of tax notices that go out. There's a family of tax notices that are very benign, and they're very kind, and they're soothing almost in their tone. You know, please call us, and we don't, you know, check this out, and we want to help you. And then there's then there's a family of notices that are heavy-handed, black boot style notices. And that final notice that I talked about is one of those notices. This is your final notice of intent to levy, notice of intent to seize your property. If you don't take action, we're going to seize everything you have. And if you don't know how to respond to the notices, I'm telling you what, they're going to run you over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can you tell us, because I understand that you testified in front of the Senate Finance Committee, can you share with our listeners what that was like and what happened with your testimony?
Yeah, absolutely. I testified in 1998 during the Senate Finance Committee hearings on IRS abuse. I provided the intellectual ammunition to the Senate Finance Committee in 1998 that allowed them to investigate and blast the IRS the way they did. That in turn led to the IRS Restructuring and Reform Act of 1999, which was passed into law and became effective that summer of 1999. My testimony before the Senate Finance Committee was very specific. I made the claim to the committee, and I made this claim to the committee during a hearing. Okay, the same claim that I made on this radio broadcast 15 minutes ago, and that is, I told the Senate Finance Committee that the IRS uses tactics of bluff and intimidation, misinformation and disinformation, and in many cases they outright bold-faced lie to people concerning what their rights are and what the agency's limitations are. And then I went from there, all right, what I just said was a very general claim, I admit that, but then I went from there and I documented 14 specific ways the IRS does exactly that. 14
wow.
different ways that they use bluff and intimidation and misinformation and lie to people concerning what their rights are. That's the summary of my testimony to the Senate Finance Committee.
And how was that taken? Did they bluster around you, or did they just quietly and sheepishly walk out with their tail between their legs?
No, I would say it was received very favorably because, as I said, I became a consultant to the National Commission on Restructuring the IRS, and we built into the Internal Revenue Code some very, very important provisions. I talked about one of them. I talked about the collection due process appeal right. But there's two others that I had that my fingerprints are all over. One of them is beefing up the innocent spouse statutes, these laws that allow an innocent spouse, somebody who is responsible for a tax liability because of signing a joint return, but she had no hand in her husband's business, had no dealings in unreported income or bogus deductions or any of those sorts of things. So we built up the innocent spouse statute to allow these, and they're typically women. It's not always women, but they're typically women. They're taken advantage of by unscrupulous men. We built provisions into the code that allowed them to get relief and get absolved of that liability. And the other thing we did, and this is very important, is we gave new important powers to the Office of the Taxpayer Advocate. Taxpayer Advocate functions as a liaison between the IRS and the taxpayer, and they can step in, and they didn't have this power before the Restructuring Act, but they have it now. They can step in and stop the IRS from taking action that it's going to take, that's causing a hardship, or they can order the IRS to take action that the agency refuses to take if their failure to act is causing a hardship. So we've got important tools now that we never had, again, when the senator was young and when I was young.
Yeah, the senator can't remember when he was young, but I'll take your word for that. But, you know, actually, the thing you said about the spouse, that's exactly what happened to my mom. Again, God bless you for that. Because
so, Dan,
you helped a lot of people.
And I appreciate that too. Can you tell us what it means that you are admitted to a practice before the United States Tax Court?
Yeah. I represent people in front of the IRS. I represent people that have problems with the IRS. I don't care if you've got an audit problem, a collection problem, if there's an appeals issue, the IRS says you owe penalties, interest, whatever it is. I represent people in front of the IRS and in front of the United States Tax Court as an advocate for taxpayers that are facing problems with the IRS. I mean, basically what we've got is a legal practice here that deals with solely and exclusively the Internal Revenue Service.
And does that go across state lines?
Absolutely. No question about it.
Because it's federal.
Everywhere in the country. I represent taxpayers all over the United States.
So what do you think is one of the common misconceptions? Because you said at the beginning of the broadcast that there's lots of lies out there. Could you give us an example of a couple of them that are perpetuated by the IRS?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And let's stay on the taxpayers' rights issue. About 2 years ago, the National Taxpayer Advocate did a survey of a representative sample of taxpayers. I forget how many. There are 1,200, 1,500 taxpayers she surveyed. And the questions were real simple. Do you, as a taxpayer, understand that you have any rights when you're dealing with the IRS? Yes or no? If the answer is yes, do you understand what those rights are? All right, those are a couple pretty simple questions, right?
Yeah.
Fewer than 50% of the people surveyed realized that they had any rights, and less than 25% of those people could name one. Now, that to me is profound. I have accused the IRS for 35 years, and I've accused them on this broadcast of not telling the truth when it comes to taxpayers' rights. Well, I knew that was true. My empirical experience taught me that it was true, and I could prove it with specific facts and circumstances, but the taxpayer advocate did a survey. She did a survey of a representative universe of taxpayers. She did a survey with valid numbers, you know, just as valid as any other survey on the planet, and she has proved unequivocally that fewer than 50% of the people even believe they have any rights, and less than half of those can name one. So the biggest problem is people just do not know what their rights are. And that's why it's so important to get some information that will tell you what your rights are. Even if you don't have a problem with the IRS today, there's nobody that's immune to getting a letter from the agency at some point along the way. And so you need to know how to deal with it.
Well, and, you know, I think the really profound thing you just said there, Dan, is in the fact that we all do this every year. We all have to do this, you know, to not this is not some obscure process, which really doesn't, affect our lives every year. In fact, if you're paid a salary and taxes are withheld, every week or 2 weeks or month, depending on how you get paid, this impacts your lives. So it really is amazing that people don't understand, what they can do. If they get in trouble with the IRS. And I think most people get these notices, you know, that this isn't something that happens very often to you. And when it happens, you just panic. What do I do?
Sure.
Who do I see? What, you know, these guys can, you know, like I say, they're exempted from, you know, this, they're exempted from due process. So you don't even know what you can do or if you can do anything. It's important to know up front. I agree.
There's just no doubt about it. I mean, people have got to know what their rights are. They don't have any. The IRS isn't going to tell you about it. There's just no question about that. It's absolutely true.
So what do we do to make the code better? And do we?
Do we want a flat
tax or what? What do we do?
What do we do to make the code better? You know, when I was called by the National Commission on Restructuring the IRS, the chief of staff called me and said, "Dan, we've got this mandate here to fix the Internal Revenue Code and to fix the IRS and you know, we're not quite sure what to do. We just quite honestly don't know what to do. What do you think?" And I said, "Okay, boys, I'll give you the solution to the problem. And I want you to take some notes." So they get their yellow pads out and they get their pencils out. And they're all ready to write. I said, "Here's what we do. We take the Internal Revenue Code up to the highest building in Washington, which, as you know, is probably only about, what, 8 stories?
Yeah, the Capitol. It's the Capitol.
We pitch it out the window. We throw the entire Internal Revenue Code out the window. We bulldoze it and start over again." And the guy looked at me and he says, "Are you serious?" I said, "I'm absolutely serious. I'm as serious as a heart attack. The Internal Revenue Code is morally unsound. It's constitutionally unsound. It's economically unsound. We have been tinkering around the edges with this tax code for, by this time, 30 years. Now we're 20 years down the road here now. So now we're close to 50 years. Good heavens. How old am I? Anyway, so I said, it's unsound morally, constitutionally, economically. It cannot be fixed. I said, if you've got a house that's built on an unsound foundation, it doesn't make any difference how many times you fill the nail holes and paint the walls. You don't fix the problem. We've got to bulldoze this thing and start over again." Of course, they set their pencils down on their paper and they slid the pad across the table and looked at me and said, "Dan, that's a great idea, but that's not our mandate. Our mandate is to fix the tax code in the IRS, not to bulldoze it and start over." And I said, and I had to confess, I knew that. I knew what the mandate was, but I wanted to have a little fun. But in answer to your question, Senator, here's the solution. The solution, truthfully, honestly, is we got to bulldoze the Internal Revenue Code. We got to bulldoze the income tax. And we got to start over, not with a flat tax, not with a value-added tax, not with any of these gimmicks. We got to go to a national retail sales tax assessed on all consumption goods and services, personal and business, at the consumer, at the point of purchase. And if we do that, we can eliminate the Internal Revenue Service lock, stock, and barrel. And we can eliminate all the problems with the IRS. We can eliminate all the problems with the income tax. And the fact that, and we will create a system that encourages savings and investment, that encourages the employment of individual workers, builds savings, builds investment, and feeds the engine of productivity. That's what will happen.
Well, and what are the odds that that's going to happen?
What are the odds? Well, you know, I wrote a book in 1993 called How to Fire the IRS. And I was pretty naive politically in those days. I had a lot of experience in dealing with the Internal Revenue Service by that time. Almost 15 years of experience by that time, 1992. Maybe not quite 15. Doesn't matter. I had zero experience politically. I wrote this book called How to Fire the IRS that laid out this plan to abolish the IRS and the income tax and go to a national retail sales tax. And I laid out the case constitutionally, and I laid out the case economically. I laid out the case morally to have this done. And I'm telling you, it was rock solid research, if I say so myself. Rock solid. And it started the national debate on whether we should abolish the IRS, which in fact led to the Restructuring Commission hearings. That's what led to it. It was that book that led to it. It was that book, How to Fire the IRS, that was the intellectual ammunition for the Senate Finance Committee hearings in IRS abuse. I said that earlier. It was that book that was the evidence for it. I believed, in my naivete, I believed that Congress would see the evidence, they would understand the case. This just sounds so silly now. They would understand the case. And they would do the right thing for the right reason. Well, who was I kidding? I had no political experience, none. Well, it didn't, you know, by 2000, by the end of the decade, I realized that Congress was never going to do the right thing for the right reason. They got 75 ulterior motives, Senator. You can name half of them. I can only name three, but they've got 75 ulterior motives for doing what they do. And very few of them have anything to do with doing the right thing. So I've come to the conclusion, this is my new conclusion now, and I think this is valid, but who knows. I believe that the only way that Congress is going to come to its senses and abolish the Internal Revenue Service and the income tax is when it becomes unenforceable. And we are moving to the point where the tax code is becoming unenforceable. And the reason is because there's so many people that simply can't pay the tax and so many businesses that can't comply with the regulations that the senator and I have been talking about here. They simply can't comply with them. There's just no way to do it. That's when the system will change.
Well, and, you know, I think people have seen that before, Dan. We as an activist, we often talk in Washington about tax resistance, and it's a problem. Tax resistance is a problem because of the way the IRS and the tax system is structured. Most of us don't even pay our own taxes. They're paid by business. They're withheld from our salaries. The penalties are draconian. But I think people, I think people more and more and more talk about those things. So, Dan, before we go, we have a few other things to take care of. But please tell us if you have a website, if there's a way people can get a hold of you.
I do. My website is taxhelponline.com. It's all one word, no spaces of any kind. Taxhelponline.com. Or you can call my phone number during regular business hours during the week, 1-800-34-NO-TAX. That's 800-34-NO-TAX. Or the website, again, is taxhelponline.com. We have materials that will help anybody with any kind of problem they have.
So I was just thinking before you leave, Dan, one of the senator's main goals in life is to not have taxation without representation. Michael, is this the activist that you need?
Well, we've put forth the no taxation idea, and strangely enough, Congress isn't interested in taking our tax burden away, since we pay more taxes in the District of Columbia than 22 different states. So, there's actually a bill put, of course, it's put forth by a Californian named Dana Raubacher to take away our taxes. And it's been it's been out there for a very long time, but Congress hasn't moved on it. So, yeah, Dan, if you can figure out a way to do that, I will start the fund to build a monument to you.
Yes.
Right here on the wall in between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial.
Well, I don't know about that, Senator, but I put it this way. I'll tell you how committed I am to abolishing the IRS. I have no other marketable skills, sir, so that means if the income tax is gone, I'm going to have to get a job selling shoes.
Oh, you can go into politics. It doesn't take any, you don't need any marketable skills to be a politician.
With all you've learned, especially.
But, yes. And thanks so much for being on the show, Dan. And maybe closer to April 15th, we can have you back again if you're not too busy to reiterate some of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I look forward to it. And, Senator, if there's any way I can help you, just give me a call. Let me know.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Perfect. Dan, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
Okay. I love the passion.
Yeah, me too. And you
did
know
you
what?
Feel the passion?
Well, yeah. And you know what? I mean, anybody that's dealt with the IRS, I can't tell you. I could go on and on and on about the little battles I had over so little money. And people would say to me, it's $100. Pay it. No. You can't pay it because that's a foot in those days. Anyway, it was a foot in the door for these people. If you know, I never gave up. I never surrendered. I sometimes spent more time and money fighting something than it was worth. But yeah, he's right. They can be really draconian. Now, I have to say from my experience last year, where my identity was stolen, I also found them to be very helpful. So maybe things are changing, and let's hope they are. But yeah, the tax code, man, if you want to louse something up, you need to get a bunch of politicians involved. I don't care what it is, you know. And the thing he said about he thought they would see the reasonableness of his argument, that's something business people see. You sit down with somebody in business and you say, look, there's a profit in it doing it this way. And everybody at the table nods. Yeah, okay. But that doesn't happen in politics. It doesn't matter if it's cheaper. It doesn't necessarily. Doesn't matter if it's a better way of doing things. You always have to know the politics involved. And the politics of the tax code are just incredible.
I just wanted to mention that I had this week a pop-up ostensibly from Microsoft came up and said, we have detected malware and spyware on your computer, and we're going to shut you down unless you call this number because you can infect our system. And it was an 8-something number. And so I called it, and the guy who answered sounded like he was from another country, which I know that they contract out to other folks around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And then he said, that's no problem. You just have to give me access, and I'll help you with this. And all of a sudden, I got this eerie feeling, like my skin was tingling. Like, I'm going to let you in, and then you're going to know all of my bank account information and my passwords and stuff. So I had enough sense to say, I have a meeting and I'll have to call you back. But you know what? That thing has since gone away and has never proved to be true. So I think it's a phishing scam.
It is a phishing scam. And I get them all the time.
Do you?
And yes. And the sad thing about it is that I've had problems with my computer where they have legitimately gone in and taken over my computer at Apple and Microsoft. So it's something that you may have done and you know, and it is legitimate, but never do that. Never give them access. You know, always you contact them if that's the problem. You know, if there's a problem, you say, can I get back to you? And then you look up the number for Microsoft or Apple or whatever and contact them, because yes, that's exactly what it is. And they also do this thing where if you click on the wrong button, then they automatically have access to your computer. They don't even need you don't even need to give them permission. They just go in. You got to be very, very careful of that stuff. So thanks for bringing that up.
They were basically saying you'll be put offline and disabled because of your threat to our system, which made sense to me. Right. But when it wasn't, it didn't. Yeah. And nobody called me back, by the way. The pop-up has never since appeared since. And I have had access. So it was a scam, obviously.
Yes. And you know what I say to these people? And I've had relative success with it. You know, they'll hang up and I hope I make it. I say to them, you're stealing. This is wrong. You're stealing from people and you need to stop it. And they immediately hang up. But I need to talk about a few things that are going on in D.C. this week. I wanted to talk about what's going on with the president, but I think we'll have plenty of time to do that in the future. But let me tell you, I had a meeting this week with a young lawyer from Utah named Damian Kidd. He's a Republican. He's going to be on the show in a few weeks, Maria.
Yay.
He's going to run against this guy, Jason Chaffetz, who is all up in the business of Washington, D.C.
What is he going to run for?
He's going to run against him as a member of Congress and try to defeat him. Jason Chaffetz, you may have recalled in recent news, was the guy that said one of the comments he made over the recent Trump revision of the health plan was if it costs people more money, maybe they should give up their cell phones and pay a little more in insurance. Well, they've just had a field day with that. Not the brightest thing to say. But he's been involved. He's head of the chairman of the Oversight Committee, and they very often get involved in affairs of D.C., or at least they have the power to do that. They don't necessarily do it, but they have the power to do it. And he's put through a resolution to try to overturn a law that the district just passed, a death with dignity law. He was successful in the House, but unfortunately for him, he wasn't able to get it into the Senate in time, so the bill passed. But he's interfered with that law. He's interfered with our budget. He's interfered with a law that would give health benefits to poor women in the district. He's interfered with the marijuana referendum. He stood in the way of a referendum to give us budget autonomy. So we're sick of it. And what we want to – so I had a meeting with him. I had a lunch meeting with him. I went to a meet and greet. I'll probably go out to Utah and help him campaign a little bit.
Really?
We want to make sure – we want to send a message out there that if you mess with the District of Columbia, there are consequences. And that's one of our problems is that these congressmen from all over the place – never from California, I must say. You people in California are all about democracy. But in other places, these guys from time to time interfere with us, and we don't do anything about it. And what happened in the 1980s is there was a very conservative guy from North Carolina named Launch Faircloth, and we sent busloads of – he did the same thing as Jason Chaffetz, and we sent – busloads of Washingtonians down to campaign for him in North Carolina, and he campaigned against him in North Carolina, and he lost. So I'm calling it the Launch Faircloth plan, but we're definitely going to go after this guy, campaign, and hopefully defeat Chaffetz. And if we don't defeat him, at least give him a hard time so that people understand you can't do this willy-nilly and get away with it. You know, this is what we do in Washington, D.C. Politics is what we do. And if you mess with us, you're going to have to pay the consequence, I think, is the message we need to get out there, because that's how we're going to protect D.C. and I think get more people on the bill if they understand, you know, let's give these guys the rights they deserve so that they don't interfere with our rights. I think that, you know, what we're going to try to do in the future. Is
this a new approach, Michael, for you to take your activism outside the District of Columbia?
Yes,
is it?
In this sense, to do it punitively, yeah. Normally, if you invited me to come to California and speak before the, you know, Republican Women of California, I would come out and give a speech about, you know, or talk to you or advocate for you to get involved to help us. But this will be the first activism on my part where I actually go out and say, look, I'm going to stand against people that stand against us. So it would be a new approach for me. Like I say, we did it in the Launch Faircloth case. Other people did it, and it worked. So I think that's, it's a wave of the future for us.
I also like it, by the way.
Yeah, me too.
Because it's going to have repercussions now, not just within where your world is, but throughout the country.
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know. The thing in Utah, too, just so you know, 80% of America doesn't understand the situation that we're in. 80% of America agrees that we should have the same rights that everybody else has, but they don't understand that we don't. So if nothing else, you get out to Utah and you get to educate the people of Utah about the situation, that's a positive thing, you know. And as it relates to your last question, for example, last year we went to the Iowa caucuses and we got referendums passed in support of our position at the caucuses, the Democratic caucuses. That's more what we do, is to try to go out and get you to support us. But I think this new approach is something that we really have to do. And I also went before the chairman of the city council and got in a fight with them because, you know, there are people internally that don't support this, and it's just terrible. You know, they give us hardly any money. They pay, the District of Columbia pays $23,000 for each child that goes to school in the District of Columbia, for one of the worst school systems in America, $23,000 a student.
Wait, that's private school education money.
Yes, and half the schools in D.C. are D.C. charter schools because the public schools fail so terribly. That's $3,000 for every man, woman, and child in the District of Columbia. $3,000 for every man, woman, and child, and they call education a priority. For affordable housing, we spend $186 million, or $300 for every man, woman, and child in the District of Columbia a year. But on statehood, we spend 33 cents. And that was my speech, is that there are no 33-cent priorities. So that was our week wrap-up in D.C. And I just
How was that received, Michael, when you made that?
The chairman of the committee, the chairman of the council who had the hearing, didn't have a stroke, but he came very close to it, I think.
Really?
You know, and I understand that there were staff people all over the building that were watching it live streamed, and that was their afternoon entertainment, me attacking the chairman. So we'll see. I go up against them again on April 25th for a budget hearing. So we'll see. We'll see if we've had any impact. But I wanted to get that in. And you know, now we're out of time, Maria, and I want to close out today. Look, I think there's a special place in heaven for people who have the courage to do that which has never been done before. And so today I want to leave everybody with a favorite song of mine from Chuck Berry and say, rest in peace.
Yeah.
You created music like the world had never seen before. So we'll see you next week. And thanks, Maria.
You're welcome, Michael. Have a great week, everyone. And thank you, Michael, for your passion.
Yeah, thank you.
As I got on a city bus and found a vacant seat, I thought I saw my future bride walking up the street. Shouted to the driver, hey, conductor, you must slow down, I think I see her, please let me off this bus. Nadine, honey, is that you? Whoa, Nadine, honey, is that you?
exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.